Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents They Called Us River Rats, The Last Batcher Settlement of New Orleans, by Macon Fry, narrated by Adam Barr. Prologue. In the early morning darkness of February 2, 2016, a straight-line wind blasted across the swollen channel of the Mississippi River just above New Orleans at Nine Mile Point. I woke to the crashing of porch furniture hurled into the river below, followed by the deep, thundering, repeated blast of a ship's distress signal. It echoed over the mile-wide river and resonated in my chest. The 816-foot Nord Bay tanker was heading downstream empty and riding high. As it navigated the bend, the starboard flank, half a football field of metal, caught the driving wind like a sail. I ran out on my deck and watched the 116,000-ton vessel graze the Jefferson Parish water intake upstream. It obliterated the steel tripods known as dolphins that are deployed to stop small things like runaway barges. With quiet grace, the ship crushed a disused oil pier that jutted in front of our dozen riverfront homes, like a garbage truck flattening a tissue box. Then the ship was abreast of us, parallel to the bank, but too close. The Nord Bay's hull scraped the concrete riverbank as its port side encompassed the entire colony. The river, the lights of the Entergy power plant on the west bank, the clouds and fleeting stars were obscured by a towering wall of steel, close enough to smell its oil and rust. Moments later, the ship glanced off the New Orleans water intake downstream. The retreating silhouette and throb of engines disappeared around the bend. The waves subsided. My neighbors, dozens of riverbank dwellers who had fled to the levee, muttered, "Holy shit." Everyone went back to bed. My first river had been the Rappahannock, a wide tidal stream off the Chesapeake Bay in Virginia, a place that would seem to give little preparation for a life on the Mississippi. My brothers and I spent every summer there in the 1960s, from grade school through high school. In early June every year, Dad drove us three boys and our mother 2 hours down from the Washington, D.C. suburbs to the tiny cabin my mother's parents built for $400 during the Depression. We left behind the smell of fresh-cut lawns and, as we crossed the Capitol Beltway, shed all the interstate traffic. When we got close and the road turned to dirt, my father drove so slowly it felt like the earth had changed its directional rotation. Mom rolled down the window to smell honeysuckle and pine needles, and finally the sulfur of marsh and river saturated everything. When we pulled into the clearing and the river came in sight, she began to sing, "Happy Days Are Here Again." Dad shooed snakes from the outhouse, primed the pump, and then left us behind to return to his job in the city. My older brother Billy and I were assigned the task of opening the windows, which we loved. The cottage was constructed of odd materials my grandfather bought from salvage yards in Richmond, the closest big city. There weren't enough matching window sets to place top and bottom sashes in each frame, so he designed a system on the back of the house where the windowsills could be lifted out and the single sash dropped into the wall. On the front of the house, the windows lifted straight up into the wall above, where they were cocked at an angle to hold them up. This created large screened openings for river breezes to gust through the cabin. Despite the inevitable mashed fingers, the system seemed miraculous to a preteen boy. There was no phone at the cottage, and after our dad dropped us off, no car. When we needed to go into town, we walked to the edge of the surrounding marsh and looked over at our cousin's farmhouse on the other side. If their car was in the driveway, we set about hollering, "Yoo-hoo!" until an aunt or uncle would come out to the opposite bank and commence yoo-hooing back. Once the correspondents had one another's attention, A short conversation at high volume commenced over the waving field of marsh grass. The Rappahannock taught me that rivers are places where days are long and punctuated by the rhythm of waves and storms. The changing seasons express themselves in the movement of sun over wide horizons. Riverbanks and mudflats were places to find and catch things and sometimes eat them. My brother and I caught fish under a cork, foraged late June blackberries, and netted August crabs. We shot guns and burned our shoulders in the sun. Our heads hung down looking for arrowheads and barnacled bottles at low tide. We wandered far but were never lost because the sky was open and the river was our GPS. It was always nearby and the land sloped down to it. Some afternoons we walked back through a pine plantation to the hardtop, picking up bottles with labels like Brown Cow, Orange Crush, and Chocolate Soldier. At Seeger's Country Store, we redeemed them for 2 cents each. 25 bottles bought a card of pre-strung fish hooks, or a couple six-packs of tiny wax containers of colored sugar water, called nickel nips. On the way back to the cottage, we somehow got laughing drunk on the stuff. My nieces now spend their summers in soccer camp and pony camp, places with rules to teach kids how to do things. Our camp was a place where there were endless opportunities for misadventure and countless ways to screw up. We suffered poison ivy and chiggers, stepped on rusty nails, pulled fish hooks through our fingers, shot BBs into each other's legs, puked salt water, and blew bits of flesh away with fireworks. The riverfront porch became a clinic where Mom applied disinfectant and bandages, swabbed sand from our eyes, and poured vinegar over jellyfish stings. My cousins built rafts of rope and logs that disintegrated at the first wave. Billy and I caulked cracks in the bottom of the rotten wooden skiff my mother bought us, aptly named Scoundrel, rigged it with a bedsheet sail, and watched it sink to the bottom. We tried to make beer by fermenting sassafras roots and sugar water in jars buried in the woods, and ended up dizzyingly sick. I always wanted to live in a place where I could imagine, find, and forage everything I wanted. I can't remember not knowing that I would live on a river. Chapter 1. The Shack. In 1981, I finished graduate school in Virginia, ready to leave the East Coast forever. The suburbs had become a suffocating place where one town ran indistinguishably into another and long, unmoving strands of traffic connected all. Recently vacant lots in modest neighborhoods and exurban fields sprouted identical boxy mansions. I had to decide early whether to buy in. I chose to sell out, step on the economic down escalator, and move to the country's easiest economy. I bought a 64 Newport with a push-button transmission and drove it down to our most un-American city, New Orleans, a place of warmth and decay on the nation's greatest river. I approached New Orleans on the straight, flat interstate over Lake Pontchartrain. Weeds grew through the road. A monolithic stone marker, New Orleans East, sank in mud and marsh grass beside a freeway exit that abruptly ended in ponds where guys in hip boots hunted snakes, alligators, and wild hogs. Suburban parking lots were virtually deserted, resting seagulls outnumbered cars. A few miles further, I found the city's cars were mostly abandoned and rusting, beached on uptown curbs. Ferns grew from gutters, and moss hung overhead from the branches of live oak trees. New Orleans was watching the exodus of its lifeblood, the oil industry. The economy had tanked, and the place looked more like the city that forgot to care than its nickname, the city that care forgot. Escaping the suburbs was easy, but dipping my feet in the Mississippi River was not. Unlike the Rappahannock River, open everywhere along its bluffs, this big river was obscured by miles of flood walls, commercial docks, warehouses, and railroads. Where the docks ended, earthen levees built by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, known to locals as the Corps, ran high above adjoining neighborhoods. There were only a few obvious windows on the water. Bridges, ferries, Audubon Park, and a small boardwalk by the French Quarter known as the Moonwalk. I rented a dilapidated shotgun house in Riverbend. The neighborhood near Tulane University is named for a curve in the Mississippi that forms the upstream portion of the looping bend that earned New Orleans another nickname, Crescent City. For 5 years, I watched the tops of ships glide past over the green swell of levee. The only life I found on the river was an old man fishing by Audubon Park. He sat on a bucket and threw a line weighted with spark plugs into the current. One cool fall night in 1985, I sat, beer in hand, at the Maple Leaf Bar, a neighborhood watering hole a few blocks from my house. Local soul singer Johnny Adams had just finished a set when a stout guy, maybe 23 years old in an aviator hat, leaned back on the bar and began spooling theories about local mafia ties to Lee Harvey Oswald and the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. I bought him a beer, and he paused to introduce himself. "I'm Rob. Where you from?" Quick to disown my suburban heritage, I replied, "I pretty much grew up on the Rappahannock River in Virginia." Rob grinned and downed his beer. "Really? I live in a camp just over the levee here on the Mississippi." 4 years in New Orleans, and I had heard of no one living on the big river. I dumped my bud in a go-cup and followed Rob 6 blocks up Oak Street, across the Public Belt Railroad, past the horse stables and the stucco turn-of-the-century sewerage and waterboard intake station. We went through the river road cut in the levee that separates Orleans from Jefferson Parish, and ascended a steep shell driveway. And there it was, that familiar, faintly sulphurous and fishy smell. The river. A clutch of 13 stilt houses floated among willow trees in a chill November fog. At the end of a plank walkway, Rob pushed open an unlocked door and lit an oil lamp. There were no sashes or screens in 2 window casements, and fog swirled in the flickering lamplight. The single 12-by-14-foot room contained a sleeping pallet, a crate of bike repair tools, and a wooden spool table served by 1 rusty lawn chair. Rob's chaotic library of environmental writings, conspiracy theories, and Louisiana political history spilled onto a burnished, bare wood floor. A plywood countertop supported an unplumbed sink and a 2-burner Coleman stove. The tiny gas oven had no supply line. No electricity, no water, no gas, no toilet. Perfect. We walked through another door, and here, just past the edge of a sagging deck, was the Mississippi itself. Lights from a grain elevator across the way and the womp-womp of a ship's propeller penetrated the billowing fog. Rob soared in my estimation. After all, this was the 80s, an era of consumptive capitalism. Downsizing would not become a buzzword for another decade. The tiny home movement was waiting for the advent of the next century. But here he was in a timeless one-room shack, next to the greatest river in the world. We settled on a 3-legged garden bench propped on cinder blocks. Rob lit a bowl of weed and laid out his plan. "I've got this idea for a jump rope. I mean, it's revolutionary, and I know Nike is going to want it. I just need to get together dough to build a prototype and buy a used car and drive out to Nike headquarters." Rob's camp, known as the Shack to all who visited, had been his first foot on the ladder of success. He paid the $75 a month rent from his pizza delivery income and earned grocery money doing bike repair, leaving just enough cash to develop the jump rope. But the rent had gone up to $100 a month, and Rob hated dominoes. He gestured at the orange and blue uniform tossed on his deck. "I gotta quit wearing the shirt of shame." I jumped in. Rob. I would do anything to live here. If you want it, you need to talk to the landlady, Mrs. Hendricks, and convince her you will pay the rent. She's pretty old, and she might want you to do a few repairs. The deck was falling off. The windows were gone, or had never existed, and I could see a flicker of lamplight through the cracks in the wall. But I was sitting on this guy's deck, breathing rich river air. No levee, no dock, no warehouse. Nothing between us and the supertankers except fish to catch and driftwood to fashion into furniture. There was no street, and thus no noise of street traffic or glare of street lamps. There was no mailbox for unwanted utility bills, but then there were no utilities either. Rob got quiet a moment and looked out into the fog. Well, you might need to pay her a couple months back rent, too. My life in the last river community on the lower Mississippi began that damp fall night. Undoubtedly, Rob was an outlier among outliers. Perhaps the only person to leave the river in a bizarre reverse migration to seek more affordable shelter in the city. He was my introduction to a long line of idiosyncratic characters and refugees, some washed up and others born along the river, drifters and dreamers, artists and writers, kooks and craftsmen, hardworking folks who helped build the city, and retirees drinking beer and loafing over fishing lines. That first night on the river, I laid awake listening to ships and towboats and watching their lights flash through the open shutters. The little house exhaled an odor of water, mud, and old wood. In the morning, I biked to my teaching gig at Fortier High School, eager to tell colleagues about this incredible new river home. My teaching assistant, Colleen, sat in our classroom, blowing cigarette smoke out a window and gossiping with Mrs. Henderson, the school librarian. Colleen lived in Pigeontown, a neighborhood just over the levee from the shack. She was about my age, a graduate of Fortier in 1973, 2 years after it integrated and instantly became an all-black public school. Mrs. Henderson looked like she had been in the school system since before Dewey created his decimal system. The ladies leaned forward and squinted in obvious incomprehension as I described the shack. Colleen inquired, "Baby, you gonna have to take a boat to get to work?" Feigning familiarity, Mrs. Henderson warned, "Be careful around those Cajuns." Neither of these lifelong residents of New Orleans had a clue that the river colony existed right beside the neighborhood where they grew up and worked. The inscrutability of the river colony begins in its hidden site. The river houses rest on the water side of a 24-foot-tall earthen levee, propped up on pilings over a narrow ribbon of sand and silt, known throughout Louisiana as the Batcher. The Oxford English Dictionary confusingly defines Batcher as a river or seabed elevated to the surface, as if seasonal stages of the river actually raise the height of the land beneath it. Some trace the word to a French nautical term referring to shoals upon which water breaks, while others suggest it derives from the French verb to beat, and refers to settlers washing laundry in the shallows or waves beating on the shoals. The Louisiana Civil Code tried to sort out the meaning, defining the batcher as accretion formed successively and imperceptibly on the bank of a river or stream. The legislature clarified that accretion as a place between the ordinary high and low watermarks. These definitions have provided personal enrichment for centuries of riparian lawyers who enjoy operating in what a friend called a gray area within a gray area, arguing over what constitutes the bank, what the ordinary high watermark is, and how to measure it. To either further understand or become totally confused, you may consult a definitive entry on the subject in the Louisiana Law Review by A. N. Yiannopoulos. For everyone but lawyers, It is enough to say the Batcher is the area between the riverside bottom of the levee, the toe, and the edge of the river when it is low. The Batcher colony wouldn't exist but for the river, the city, and the levee builders. Any one of those things, however, might yet destroy it. The river built all the land under the city of New Orleans during the millennia before European settlement, casting about its low floodplain and depositing sediment. It built a natural levee of sediment along its edge and formed the low, seasonally flooded Batcher within its flanks. New Orleans was founded and grew on the landward slope of the natural levee. The land was soft and low and prone to overtopping in the spring. French colonists who founded the city in 1718 watched it fill with muddy water the following year. By 1727, they had built a 3-foot-tall, mile-long berm atop the natural one. Thus began a 300-year struggle in which levee builders have raised and hardened walls around the city, and the river has continued to threaten them, and occasionally to breach and overtop them. The river still has agency between its levees, where my Batcher camp rests. On the outside of bends, it swings hard against the shore and creates a constantly eroding cut bank. Opposite, on the inside of bends, the current slows, deposits sediment, and creates a wider Batcher, or a building bank. At building banks, the Batcher can grow to thousands of feet wide. In South Louisiana, where there is so little high ground, the wide Batchers became valuable real estate. The harrowing battle between the river and levee builders didn't forestall a secondary contest on the Batcher. Ordinary citizens, colonial powers, wealthy landholders, barons of commerce, local governments, and even a United States president fought for control of the water's edge. Rails, wharves, warehouses, and shipping terminals came to mark the winners in this battle for the Batcher, but they would also hide another wave of claimants. In a stroke of linguistic hubris, the levee builders and economic elites who walled off the waterfront described the area occupied by city folk as inside the levees. This rubric established the Batcher as an unprotected no-man's land, where the river was a permanent frontier. By definition, Batcher dwellers would be outsiders, living in an ephemeral wilderness at the city's edge, built by the river and shaped by the city, and eventually by the all-powerful core. Batcher dwellers weren't lured to the river frontier by colonial land grants or state-sponsored homesteading. There was no land rush among river folks for a fortune to be made on the wave-swept silt. They took root in the same manner as the seeds of willows and buttonbush, carried by the current and winds of the river valley. They wafted over the levee, drifted from the wintry north, and fled the storms that rolled across the Gulf of Mexico and Cajun Prairie. Today's 12 Batcher camps, Rob's Shack was lost to fire in the 1990s, are a window into the untold story of New Orleans' 140-year-old outsider community, a line village that once extended over much of the city's riverfront. It is a narrative that telescopes to farms and cities and mountains far upriver, and periscopes to battles fought with city folk just over the levee. It is a tale of wharf rats and river gypsies, of shanty boaters and stilt house people, of frontiersmen and refugees fleeing fires, floods, and economic hardship. It's my story, too. Chapter 2. Mile Marker 104. My Batcher colony can't be found on Google Street View. It is not a city place, but a river place. Consult a harbor map or the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers navigation chart for the lower Mississippi, and between mile marker 103 and 104, 104 river miles above the Gulf of Mexico, you will see it. A gaggle of 12 unlabeled, tiny black rectangles, nestled in the outside curve across from Nine Mile Point. The curve is depicted as two conjoined bends, Southport and Greenville, but the entirety is commonly referred to by the name of the community at its heart, Carrollton Bend. In River Pilot language, today's bachelor houses are on the left bank descending, near Southport, where the parishes of Orleans and Jefferson meet. The river at Carrollton Bend has dramatically shaped the lives of bachelor and city folks alike. The Mississippi forms a 6-mile crescent that begins just above the colony and circumscribes what locals call Uptown New Orleans in a bulging peninsula of sorts. The city is pinched at its upriver extreme, across from my camp by the finger of 9 Mile Point, and downriver, across from the French Quarter by the thumb of Algiers Point. For river pilots and levee builders, Carrollton Bend is one of the most dangerous compound bends below Baton Rouge. The current hurtles around 9 Mile Point and swings with centrifugal force on the cut bank where my colony stands. The river pushes ships and barges against this bank, and at times has undercut slabs of bachelor, wharves, and levee. It has claimed the lives of fishermen and swimmers and caused the surrender of entire city blocks. Amidst all of this mischief, the bend became a refuge for stilt house folk able to adapt to the river's vagaries. Shanties, shacks, hovels, huts, and dens. Local newspapers could never settle on what to call the homes of bachelor dwellers, but they obviously did not resemble city houses. For a century, bachelor residents have referred to their homes as camps. Stretching upriver from Camp 1, directly on the Orleans-Jefferson Parish line, the 12 remaining camps are attached to about 300 yards of shore by 50-foot-long catwalks. In an odd bit of symmetry, either end of the colony is embraced by a city water intake and marked by 150-foot-high steel towers that carry electricity across the river from the Entergy power plant visible on the opposite bank. The camps have always been continuously occupied. They have never been part-time hunting, fishing, or vacation cottages, as the epithet might imply. The name camp springs from their informal, whimsical design. Bachelor camps are to contemporary housing what outsider art is to motel prints. Because they are self-built, not subject to common rules, covenants, or codes, and have been wildly modified by successive generations, no two bachelor houses are ever alike. The guiding precepts of architecture outside the levees have always been affordability and the eccentric whims of their inhabitants. Combine these with an affinity for found or repurposed materials and untrained builders, and you have a classic camp. A writer who visited the Carrollton Bend settlement in 1937 noted, "A man can build himself a home for nothing more than the cost of a few nails in this city, if he has a skiff and patience. Out at the end of Magazine Street and across the levee, there's a little settlement of such homes, built mostly from lumber salvaged from the river after being discarded by workmen and repairmen upstream. Laborers and artists looking for affordable digs, fishermen and maritime folks who preferred life on the water, and refugees of all types built camps. They weren't the martinis at sunset crowd." Maybe this is why residents have always referred to the river side of their houses as the back, a notion that seems totally perverse to me, and to the levee side as the front. This may also be why so few houses had windows, much less decks, overlooking the river. The bachelor of 1986 was not the plantation south of Tidewater, Virginia, where my family had riverfront property. I didn't get inside all the homes of my neighbors right away, but the old ones still haven't changed much. A quick inventory produced no typical camp. Camp 11 was home to Mary, whose two husbands had lived and died there of mysterious causes. There were no windows on the river's side, and only one facing the levee, and nothing to see if there were. The structure was smothered in vines. Its architectural signature was a 10-by-10-foot room protruding from the barely sloped roof. In a harbor town, this tower might be a place to gaze out and await the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?